You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everyone, and welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm your host, Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Thanks for joining us on yet another steamy afternoon across the state of Wisconsin with lots of steamy news for you today. We've got the state biennial budget. We've got the big, brutal bill getting a vote in the Senate, a tie vote with the vice president breaking that tie. We've got some action on RFK's approach to vaccinations and overall public health, getting a big decision from a federal court today. We're going to cover all of that. I've got a fabulous expert guest here to help me explain some of the Supreme Court's rulings of this past week that were incredibly impactful about what lays in the future for us as citizens. His name is Jim Santel. He'll be with me through this entire show. And Jim and I are very pleased to welcome State Senator and ranking member of the state's Joint Finance Committee, Senator LaTanya Johnson. Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show, Senator. Thank you for making time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us what happened this afternoon in the JFC. What was the vote and what are we looking at in the state's biennial budget?
Well, today we had an opportunity to vote on the finalized budget. A lot of negotiations went into this budget, especially on the Democratic side. We were invited to the table fairly late in terms of leadership, but our input made a world of difference in trying to make sure that this budget did as little harm as possible, and we were able to get some good things for the citizens of Wisconsin. So this isn't the budget that we would have chose to create being a Democrat, but we definitely played a part in making sure that the budget was as palatable as possible.
Tell us about some of those improvements over both the current biennial budget and where Republicans, as led by Senator LeMahieu and Assembly Speaker Voss, had offered as sort of a response to the governor's introduced budget.
So one of the major differences where we played a pivotal role was childcare. We know that the governor proposed $480 million for childcare counts. We know that we were at risk of losing almost 88,000 slots if childcare providers closed their doors. So we were instrumental in getting more than $300 million to keep childcare centers open. It won't be called child care counts, and that's okay. The name isn't important, but we were successful in making sure that we got $110 million in monthly payments to child care providers for basic operating costs such as payroll and rent, $66 million for a new state-funded program called Get Kids Ready, and that's designed for four-year-olds. Putting some of those kids, allowing them to be served in daycare centers so they don't have to be pulled out and put into the K-4 programs, but making sure that they're still school ready. And also, one of the most important things that I'm most proud about is raising the childcare rates to the 75th percentile, which is required by state law anyways. But that's essentially giving childcare providers a raise across the board for the kids that they're caring for, which is extremely important in keeping their doors open. We played a pivotal role in making sure that reimbursement rates were raised for special needs children. Our state Republicans stopped at around 35%. With negotiations between Democrats, we were able to raise those rates to 42% in the first year, 45% in the second. Another thing that we were able to do, instead of $80 million in cuts for the UW system, we're now investing $256 million over the two-year period in the UW systems, making sure that they're able to stay afloat. So we were able to do some really, really pivotal things in making sure that this budget did the least amount of harm as possible.
Folks, if you're just joining us, the big news out of the state of Wisconsin is that the Joint Finance Committee has approved a biennial budget. Senator, you are the only Democrat sitting on the Joint Finance Committee to vote for this biennial budget. And I think it's incredibly important. Again, these three areas of critical funding, childcare, special education reimbursement rates, and of course the UW system funding. The UW system funding swing alone, again, going from $80 million in cuts to $256 million in additional investment, that's $336 million in swing, plus that additional $300 million for childcare, those reimbursement rates for special education across the public school system. If you can, again, we're seeing tweets coming out from Chris Larson, Francesca Hong in opposition. Can you address some of those criticisms of the budget? And can you address some of your colleagues on the Joint Finance Committee from the Democratic Party voting against this biennial budget?
Yes, like I said before, this is not a budget that we would have chose to introduce had we been allowed to play a more pivotal role. Since being elected to this to the state legislature since 2013, being able to vote for a portion of this budget or just having the opportunity to vote for this budget was extremely important because this budget, out of all of the budgets that I've witnessed, truly has a bipartisan stamp on it. Before, it was just the governor and key players on the Republican side crafting the budget. But when those talks broke down and they were at a standstill, then Democratic leadership was invited to the table. These are truly items that we fought for. We had to go and make a decision on what areas would most impact our constituents and the constituents around Wisconsin, regardless of what party that they're from. And I can honestly say that we helped to make a bad budget better. And sometimes, you know, in leadership, that's all that you can hope for or ask for. And in terms of being a leader, sometimes when bipartisan efforts are made, then you have to vote for that on behalf of just the sheer intent. We finally had an opportunity to actually contribute and to actually get something in the budget, and that was worth my vote for this bill. It's not a perfect bill. It never will be when you are operating on true bipartisanship. You know, it was said in Joint Finance that every single budget that they introduce has been a bipartisan effort, and I don't necessarily agree with that, right? The governor signs the budget, true, but we all know what happens if he doesn't sign the budget. You have vulnerable communities and neighborhoods and schools that are relying on those funds and relying on that the budget to be passed. And if it's not passed, you know, and we're allowed to break for the summer, there's no rush to come back and start over. But yet those communities and the schools still suffer. And so because of that, Governor Evers realizes that, you know, the path of least resistance and to make sure that those vulnerable communities don't suffer is to sign the budget. This time we had an opportunity to provide a lot more input, and it showed at the end with all of the things that we were able to accomplish.
If I can be so bold, Senator Johnson, as to make this observation, the Democrats that have seen coming out in opposition with Representative Hong as an exception to this, white folks, right? And I think there needs to be an observation, which you made, I think, quite expertly, and that is communities facing the most acute harms at greatest risk. We have to be attuned to and to understand that sometimes in negotiated bipartisan solutions, the harm reduction needs to be emphasized and elevated as opposed to comparing what is and what is possible to what we would wish for. That is not the delta. The delta is, the difference is, how much harm was going to happen with no budget or with a budget under significant delay. And I think we may have just lost the senator. We're going to work to get her back. Jim, I'm going to pivot to you a bit here. I have been through budget negotiations. I was at the county and working with our city counterparts during the sales tax negotiations just a couple of years ago. And I watched Democrats, frankly, that were a bit left, perhaps some very far left, oppose these compromise solutions on largely ideological grounds, based off the failure to achieve perfection. Mm-hmm. And again, I heard from a lot of elected Black leaders, hey, you do not understand the harm that may befall some of our most at-risk communities. I applaud elected officials that take these tough votes, that do not let the perfect stand in the way of the good. Your thoughts on the state's biennial budget?
Absolutely. And so that those folks who come forward and say, we've got to be thoughtful about what's going on right down the street, right? Those operations that are affecting people. And if you place this ideological position above everything else, people are not served. The interests of the community are not addressed. And the other thing that I would say in following up on the senator's very good comment, and she's back with us now, is you and I both know, all of us know, if everybody leaves a room in litigation and even in legislation, everybody's a little bit unhappy, you probably have a settlement that's going to last and make some sense. And you can also, Senator, as you just said, you can explain that to people, as you just did. You're confronted by others of all parties and asked about your vote, you can explain the reasons, the practical reasons for doing it. Everybody leaves a little bit unhappy. We can't get everything we want in a good democratic system. That's your point, right, Senator?
Correct. It is. There were some things there that were really hard pills for me, such as the increase daily rates for Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. Before, we thought that those were going to be $840,000 per juvenile offender per year, it's $912,000 for the first year. And the second year is $1.6 million. So there was some really, really poor decision making and spending in this budget, but there were a lot of really good things to applaud as well.
As I hear you, State Senator LaTanya Johnson, we need to educate, not incarcerate. That has the largest return on a taxpayer dollar. I applaud you for your leadership, for the tough vote, for the tough negotiations. What do you want to say to Wisconsinites that might have reservations? We've got just about 30 seconds left, Senator.
I want to say that this is a proven record right here that when we work together, we're able to accomplish things for taxpayers. And this was a clear indication of bipartisanship. Nobody got everything that they wanted, but we did. We were forced to come to the table, sit down, and make some tough decisions. And that was what was most important.
You're accomplishing here much in the way of child care, special education, and our university system. Congratulations, Senator LaTanya Johnson, for your leadership in what was a grueling budget debate. We'll be back. Jim Santel and I discuss more right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I want to thank my co-host for the rest of today for being the guest host on this very program on Friday. Also, big thanks to my colleague Matt Rothschild for sitting in the guest host chair for me yesterday. Matt's going to also be here on July 3rd. We have a very special pre-July 4th celebration here on the Maggie Dawn for you schedule, Maggie Dawn Show scheduled for tomorrow, July 3rd. Do not miss tomorrow's show. We take a brief break, if you will. We look past with a historian from the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. We observe our present with Professor Emeritus Howard Schwaber of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a political scientist. And then we look forward with a media expert and another political scientist from the University of Wisconsin-Madison about how do we talk about these things? How do we build bridges? How do we actually reach the compromise that State Senator LaTanya Johnson just discussed with us? Big thanks to the senator for being here. Again, she ticked off a couple of huge, I'm going to call them enormous improvements over the budget that the GOP or the MAGA regime here in the state had proposed. Again, to summarize, that includes $300 million for childcare, reimbursement rates that will finally get above the 40% mark, reaching 45% for special education funding here in the state. Instead of $80 million in cuts to the UW system, $256 million of additional investment, making for a $336 million swing. And the one thing that we weren't able to get to with the senator is that there is increased funding for Medicaid in this budget compromise. The increases, those increases will go to help hospitals pay to fund their Medicaid patients. Again, it increases the amount hospitals pay to the state to help fund Medicaid payments, but raising the percentage of their net patient revenue. So this is incredibly important. That fact, the Medicaid improvement, may be so critical in light of the big, brutal bill's passage in Washington, D.C. What an odd irony, Jim, that we're looking at the big, brutal bill's passage in the Senate. Of course, now the House has to deal with the differences between the big, brutal bills that each chamber adopted. But what an irony that the day that our U.S. Senate adopts the big, brutal bill with a vice presidential tie-breaking vote, on the same day that our Joint Finance Committee here in Wisconsin passes our biennial budget.
Right. We've got a 50-50 vote in the United States Senate. How fascinating as an historical matter. Vice President comes in and casts the deciding vote. Not surprising, but talk about eking something out. And again, Maggie, to your good points about the content of what's going on in that federal bill as opposed to the state bill, Medicaid, we're seeing, again, huge cuts with respect, and the federal system with respect to medical coverage for people in America, millions of people here. Again, not an easy thing. We always have to struggle through these issues, but the possibility here of doing something positive in an area where our federal government may soon be cutting back, and that will have an impact upon the state of Wisconsin. Here, our budget, as the senator was saying, as you're recounting, making some real percentage changes there that are going to have an impact upon health care in Wisconsin to the good. May not be the 110% good that everybody was hoping for, but that's what compromise is all about. And I could not agree with you more that we need to be supportive of and even laud the people, including the senator and others, who look at this and say, okay, I can go back to my constituents and I can explain what I have done. And I've got you don't even have to describe it as the best thing I could possibly get. I advocated for this. We've got a good deal here. And maybe not great, but we've got a good deal here, and it's going to inure to the benefit of Wisconsinites.
Well, and I just, first of all, let me just say, from a procedural perspective, folks, if you're wondering what comes next, the full legislature has to take a vote tomorrow. If it passes tomorrow, query, I think it is passable without Democrat. I know it's passable without Democratic support. I think there will be some Democratic support for it, as State Senator Johnson's vote from the JFC indicated. Again, that vote, the full legislature, tomorrow, Wednesday. The governor then has 10 days to decide how he's going to wield his partial veto powers and or sign the budget using those partial veto powers. The governor's office has said those elements of the biennial budget that were negotiated, that were compromise solutions, he will not use his partial veto powers on. So again, something to keep watch of here. Another thing that Senator Johnson pointed out to us is that if this budget is not signed, meaning our state's biennial budget, prior to the federal budget reconciliation bill being signed by President Trump, the state could lose somewhere in the ballpark of $1.1 million. Now, again, in the grand scheme, not a huge deal, but that's still $1 million for, again, healthcare in Wisconsin. So there is some time pressure here. Again, a negotiated solution. Jim, we got into this briefly, but I want to ask again, having been in rooms when I have watched Democrats and Republicans negotiate highly contentious fiscal issues, I have always been appalled by both the far right and the far left's penchant for what I'm going to call the easy vote that appeases the base. Well, I object because other people will take the tough votes and actually get the thing done.
Right.
I think it's frankly kind of a cop-out.
It is, and it works on a campaign poster then, right? I'm the one who voted for you. What is the impact of that? Well, I didn't vote for something practical once again, and I wasn't the guy who took some lumps also for doing just that. That's the problem.
The poetry of campaigns versus the prose of actual governance. Again, congratulations to Senator LaTanya Johnson and Governor Evers for getting us forward on this budget. Stay tuned. Jim and I dig into the Supreme Court next. Welcome back, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Got a fine co-host with me today. His name is James Santel. You can find his show, Amicus, a Law Review, on Saturday mornings across the network from 9 to 11. We're going to get to the Supreme Court big, big decision from last week. Thanks, Jim, for being in the chair on Friday to handle that puppy.
We knew it was coming, right?
Yes.
And I knew you were monitoring it, too. I was getting wonderful notes from you about what is this all about, right? As we're trying
to digest
hundreds of pages all of a sudden of material.
I can be camping and consuming massive amounts of Supreme Court decisions at the same time. I wanted to answer a quick question that came in from our friend Bob in Madison. Hey, Bob, thank you for listening. He texted in on the from WMDX. Again, if you have questions or comments, you can join us via phone or text at 855-752-4842. Again, that's 855-75-CIVIC. Bob, on the Wisconsin biennial budget passed today by the Joint Finance Committee, going to a full vote before the legislature tomorrow, Wednesday, asked this: the Wisconsin compromise budget bill sounds too good to be true. What's the catch? How did we get here? What's going on? And I think the lion's share of objection coming from Dems that I have seen on the Twitter, or what used to be known as the Twitter, et cetera, has been around public school education, that general school aids weren't increased, and we still have per-pupil funding that basically lags inflation. So that has been a point of contention for a long time. And when we look at special education, again, State Senator LaTanya Johnson, joining us for the first segment of the day, pointed out that they have been able to increase the reimbursement rate for kids that are special needs or SPED, special education, if you're in the education field here in Wisconsin. They had been at 35%. Those are the reimbursement percentages. Mind you, our voucher schools are at a reimbursement rate, I believe, of 90%. So why are the public schools getting, for lack of a better term, you know, the pointy end of the stick when it comes to special education? Dems had been aiming at a 60% reimbursement rate. They negotiated up to 42% for the first year of the budget, 45% for the second year of the budget. That is a significant win. Again, that's a 10%, you know, a 10-point increase. They're still 15 short of goal, but like, yeah, that's what happens when you have a Republican-controlled legislature. So I think a lot of the angst is around that public school funding, but that has always been a point of contention. And frankly, if you zoom out and you look at the sorts of legislation that Republicans have been advocating for and frankly existentially advocating for since Ronald Reagan, Their objective is the defunding of public education. So in any and every way that we can shore up those funds, especially for our kids that have the highest level of need, in other words, our special education students, that is a significant improvement. Not enough for some, but again, if you happen to be in a royal blue legislative district in this state and you get to just vote no because you'll never have to face constituents that really wanted the compromise, that's an easy no. It's those that represent the communities at greatest risk, those in leadership that are making these hard compromises and taking these hard votes.
And, you know, one of the other things that the senator hinted at, we didn't have a chance to go into it in great detail, was the future, right? And you asked a question about this as well. When you do these kinds of things, you send a message to those people, the naysayers, yes, but also the people who understand exactly the civics that we're talking about here today. It's also about the future. Here we have a situation where, again, not everybody happy with this resolution, lots of things you would have preferred to have gotten. But, again, we've got to get a, there'll be another budget cycle coming up all too soon. And maybe it begins to send the message that these pie-in-the-sky aspirations on both left and right simply will not stand. And maybe instead of doing this 48 hours before where we've got to have this all done, maybe we come to, in the wake of the listening sessions, come to some resolutions that are maybe closer to the middle, that great, wonderful middle where government probably should be. We do it in a way that acknowledges that this is government. This is the way it works, and it sends that message about the next time around as well.
And again, I have deep, basically reverential respect for Democrats that have to take these difficult votes, and they do so knowing that, frankly, arguing about harm reduction or harm avoidance is not a politically salient or easy path, that incremental improvements are not always the easiest political sell. But again, it really interesting time. Keep your eyes on what the state legislature does tomorrow. Again, once approved by the state legislature, the governor has 10 days. But keep in mind, keep your eye on the big, brutal bill in our U.S. Congress, because we need our budget before the U.S. Congress adopts the budget reconciliation bill, and it is signed by the president in order to maximally preserve Medicaid funding in this state. I just wanted to give us the chance and give our listeners a chance to weigh in on, to talk a bit about the birthright citizenship decision from Friday. And folks, there are looking to be some big decisions still coming down the pike. There's the 1849 abortion law opinion. That's coming from our state Supreme Court. Again, we're going to have the House and the U.S. Congress vote on the budget reconciliation bill because it's not the same as what they adopted back in May. So lots of things happening tomorrow. Keep your eyes on the news. I had so many reactions to the birthright citizenship case, which actually wasn't the birthright citizenship case that many thought it was. And the first one was, this was a case, and the majority clearly leaned into this quote-unquote technical interpretation or question that had been posed, and that is, can a district court issue a nationwide or universal injunction that materially impacts the rights of parties not before the court? And the majority in this decision that came down on Friday looked back to the way things used to be.
History once again. There it is. History and tradition. We've heard that before, haven't we, Maggie?
In the early times, and looking at bills of peace and all kinds of stuff, which we don't need to get into because it's hyper-technical, and to say, listen, district courts have a limited scope. And the idea that nationwide injunctions can reach the rights of non-parties when there may be other vehicles to do so is really interesting. There are problems with this, of course. That is, basically what they were saying is go seek class actions. And there were a number of class actions about birthright citizenship and other matters immediately filed on Friday because, frankly, people expected this from this court. Hoped differently, but expected and had to plan for this eventuality. But to me, the much broader context here, Jim, is the fact that this court, the majority of this court, seems to a large degree to be both incapable of, unwilling to, and utterly either ignorant or willfully blind to the real harms that yes. are being acted upon people who do not have resources mm-hmm. and access. That is primarily what I see here. And so folks don't need to know what class actions are or nationwide injunctions. What the court did on Friday was say, you have to be able to go find a lawyer and potentially pay a lawyer in order to protect your rights. And I think that that is overarchingly challenging for us as a democracy in this moment, in this particular moment. Maybe 10 years ago, I wouldn't be so concerned about it. But in this moment, I think it's deeply concerning.
Absolutely. And you've got to be able to find that lawyer. You've got to be able to find the courthouse, which, again, the lawyers can do for you. Got to be able to articulate actually your particular harm. And then you've got to be a part of litigation that goes on. And that will happen now, as many people have said, in the wake of this multiple times across America. And, you know, it's so disappointing. I had this same reaction as you did, Maggie, as I'm reading through this and hearing about it, of course, on headlines. And we're on your show on Friday, quite literally, with the ink still wet on the
yes.
order. And I'm thinking aloud about the oral argument. And it sure seemed to me as if Amy Coney Barrett was getting at something, which is, again, as we talked about, even the budget, right? Right down the middle, right? She seemed to be articulating this view that maybe what the court needs to do, as difficult as this is linguistically and operationally, needs to articulate a rule. As you just said, there are these large mammoth issues out there having to do with things like constitutional rights that apply to every single person. And it seemed as if Amy Coney Barrett was saying, as to those, we can perhaps identify some categories, maybe describe them definitionally. Other things may not be in that large category. And so we define a rule that lower courts said, again, they will interpret it differently. We'll have to have more appeals on all that. This is not an easy question, right? And so sometimes this notion, and again, it's written by Amy Coney Barrett. It strikes me as the kind of thing Alito would write, which is this hard line, bright line test and this approach to litigation and to jurisprudence that permits of no gray areas, strikes me that this is one of those areas where the Supreme Court would have, again, with great criticism, I'm sure, heaped upon it, identify some considerations, as they sometimes do in voting rights cases, civil rights cases, that lower courts should address in deciding whether or not the particular order that I am entering should extend beyond the Eastern District of Wisconsin, should extend beyond these particular plaintiffs. How far should it go? And then you appeal that, right? But give us some latitude to make all that, right?
One, the court doesn't do that. They've seemed substantially disinclined to do that in any of these cases. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that many of these cases, and listen, Donald Trump has accessed the Supreme Court's emergency docket or shadow docket 19 times.
Since January 20th, right?
Correct. Outstripping the totals of basically every other presidency and doing so in the first four and a half months of his presidency, 6 months now of his presidency. This is the problem. Whatever you may think about immigration and its enforcement, immigration and the way that we treat people who may be here illegally is the canary in the coal mine for individual rights. And if you have a Supreme Court that is, one, making access to the courts to vindicate individual rights more expensive and more difficult, while they are constraining the powers of the courts to respond to overreach or outright lawlessness by a president and his or her administration, what you have then is the court very much leaning into itself as the weakest branch. Mm-hmm. And that works only when Congress is able to step up and check executive power, which brings me all the way back to the idea that this court has again and again, specifically in the gerrymandering cases, not acted to ensure that Congress remains truly representative of us, the people. And that is leading to this gross imbalance of powers. We're going to dive a little bit deeper on that. What do we do about this? What do we do next? What does it look like? And are Democrats always playing catch up? Mm-hmm. We discuss this next. Jim Santel and I, your host, Maggie Dawn, right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join us, 855-752-4842. Text lines are open. Little problem with the phone line, so text in your thoughts and comments. We'll be back after these brief messages.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Here's what we've got right now. And I think if anybody from the Trump team had been candid with American voters back in October, September, or August, about what we're seeing right now, I don't think he wins. Because let's zoom out. We've got to see what the Supreme Court decided on Friday when it comes to these nationwide injunctions without reaching the merits of whether or not the 14th Amendment means what it says. Here's what we've got right now. We've got people being snatched off our streets by folks without identification with masks on. They disappear sometimes for weeks on end. They don't have the right to call a lawyer. Some of them have been then deported to not their country of origin or their citizenship, but to some of the most dangerous places on planet Earth, where they fear further kidnapping, potential torture, without a hearing, apparently. We have an administration who has flouted multiple court orders to stop doing that. We have an administration that, according to many, has illegally deployed military to patrol our own streets to tamp down on a handful of people creating chaos and destroying property. But worse happens when the Lakers win the championship, right? Like, all of this is happening. We're having elected officials taken down and handcuffed, elected officials arrested for doing what they considered to be their job and well within the bounds of their discretion.
And indicted by grand juries, apparently, right? We've got a congressman.
And indicted by grand juries. So importantly, today, relating to birthright citizenship, the government was required to tell a judge, hey, are babies about to be deported? I want you all to pause on that, because the Supreme Court on Friday was more interested in the process of our court system and less interested in people's individual rights. Babies can be deported. And the judge yesterday specifically asked the government lawyer, are you going to start deporting babies? Well, today, that judge's question was answered in writing by the U.S. government. And they said, starting on July 27th, babies may be deported. And I want you all to think about that. Again, the way that we treat folks accused of crimes, the way that we treat people who are here allegedly illegally, is certainly a canary in the coal mine. But consider this. Those whom citizenship is guaranteed under the 14th Amendment are facing deportation as babies in 26 days in the United States of America. Donald Trump, over the last 2 weeks and again today, has made noises about, quote, denaturalization and deporting people who are citizens. With what process? Who knows? But what I can tell you is the Supreme Court will be more worried about the process and the technicalities than they are with the substantive rights of American citizens. Again, these are canaries in the coal mine, and they are dying, folks. It is high time we pay attention to this. Now, the solution, we're not there yet with Congress. Slowly, maps are getting better, but again, the Supreme Court utterly unconcerned with that, apparently. So who is it left to stand up to a wannabe tin pot dictator? Guess what? It's you. And there is a direct line, in my opinion, from the increasing dissatisfaction across the United States in every district, including districts that used to be fairly ruby red. People are not okay with this. People are not okay with stripping citizens of their citizenship and deporting them to who knows where. Imagine a baby being deported whom days ago, you know, like on Thursday, was not subject to deportation. It's not supposed to be this way, and we all very much deserve better. So it's going to be up to each and every one of us. The courts will do some things. And to answer a question from our friend Ross in Crawford County, yes, federal district courts can still enter injunctions that specify the rights of the parties before them. And if the specification through a preliminary injunction or a temporary restraining order that is specifically tailored to provide complete interim relief to the parties before it does provide some relief to third parties within the jurisdiction of that district court, that's still good. That's why what Donald Trump and all of the MAGAs were saying on Friday were outright lies. Right. The Supreme Court didn't rule that he can strip birthright citizenship away. It simply dealt with the process to get there. But what that does anticipate is a flood of lawsuits across the country. And our courts are not equipped for that at their current size. So court reform is going to be necessary. The next thing that I'll share with you is that state attorneys general become incredibly important, because where a state can articulate standing, a state, of course, is going to be able to litigate on behalf of its citizenry and taxpayers. So we need activist attorneys generals that are deeply concerned about their citizens' rights. Do we have one here in Wisconsin? Only time will tell. But most of all, this is about you. Is it okay for an administration to willy-nilly violate rights when no court can stop them nationwide, so says the Supreme Court? What if they came for your guns? What if they say that women don't get any federal benefits? Is that okay? I say not. We continue our discussion on the other side. Jim and I are going to dig into the big, brutal bill and its impacts in Wisconsin. Phone lines and text lines are open, 855-752-4842. This is...
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.